On December 23rd, 1776, that's just less than a month shy of 240 years ago, an essay appeared in print that George Washington thought was so inspiring that he ordered it read to the American Army just 2 days before he ordered the attack upon Trenton. It was the first in a series of essays that came out during the course of the following several years and that bore the collective name of The Crisis. These essays were the work of Thomas Paine. And this particular one, the inaugural essay in the series, began with these memorable words. I'm not going to do any more than to quote the opening paragraph of the essay. You can find it online and you can read the whole thing. But the opening of the essay is most memorable, and it is so for me in a number of ways, because when I taught speech years ago, students were assigned this paragraph as one of the selections in which to learn how to recite something aloud. So I've heard these words a number of times, but not in more recent years. But these were the words with which that essay opened. These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands by it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. What we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. It is dearness only that gives everything its value. Heaven knows how to put a proper price upon its goods, and it would be strange indeed if so celestial an article as freedom should not be highly rated. Britain, with an army to enforce her tyranny, has declared that she has a right not only to tax, but to bind us in all cases whatsoever. And if being bound in that manner is not slavery, then is there not such a thing as slavery upon earth? Even the expression is impious, for so unlimited a power can belong only to God. Those words appeared at a time when it seemed that the cause of American independence was lost. The year 1776, in which the Declaration of Independence was signed, featured one military reversal, catastrophe, some would say, after another, to the point that at the end of the year, as the end of the year was drawing on, there were not very many troops who were fit to give battle. But the effect of this essay, read as it was in the ranks, was astounding. 2 days later, the shivering American army, numbering probably no more than 2,000 to 3,000 men, crossed the half-frozen Delaware River on Christmas night, 1776, divided itself into three even smaller parts of the force, and attacked the Hessian outpost at Trenton from three sides after marching all night through an ice storm. And they routed the Hessians completely. In the week that followed, back across the river at their winter quarters on the Pennsylvania side of the river, many of the army soldiers agreed to re-enlist, a prospect that had not appeared to be viable. And then they crossed the river again and again defeated the British at Trenton in the last days of 1776, and then defeated them again at Princeton in the first days of 1777. And those military victories really served to avert the disaster of the end of the war. In a similar fashion, King Hezekiah and his advisors faced a formidable challenge, as recorded in three different passages in the Old Testament. We read one of the passages in 2 Kings 18, verses 17 to 37. Then there is another somewhat shorter passage in 2 Chronicles 32, verses 9 through 20, along with a passage in Isaiah 36, 1 to 22. And it will be profitable for you to take those three passages together, as it were, to read them one after another, and you will see the great similarity that exists, and yet in some of the passages there are additional details. You may remember that we spoke about how in the 14th year of the king's reign, he paid tribute money to the Assyrians when they invaded Judah for the first time. But he could not avert the invasion by force in overwhelming numbers that soon occurred. It was without doubt the most severe test that the kingdom had faced in its entire history. And the prognosis, as it was with the American force at the end of 1776, must have appeared to be very bleak. And the collapse of the kingdom's defenses, almost inevitable. They were hopelessly outnumbered. How would Hezekiah and his people respond? For them, the hour had arrived when they had to face the crisis. And I want you to think upon that subject with me this evening. My introduction to the concept of a crisis came in the fall of 1962 when I heard my parents discussing something they called the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now, for some people here, perhaps for most of the people here, that's an expression that you may have read in a history book. But I didn't read about it in a history book. I heard my parents discuss it. That was also the first time I heard the name of Fidel Castro, who died this last Friday at the age of 90. From the reaction of my parents, I learned that a time of crisis is one of uncertainty about the effects of a situation that tends to arise without a lot of warning. For my father, the response for him was fairly direct. He and the other members of his unit and all the other duty personnel on the base received their orders to vacate the base and to establish their headquarters somewhere in the fields so that if the base were attacked, the military force would not be directly affected. Their dependents remained behind, however, and I have wondered about that in the years since, and what that said about the attitude toward the families of the servicemen. My mother appeared to be certain, as I remember it, that the only outcome of the situation was going to be war. And war that would be unprecedented in its scale. And since we were reasonably close to the front lines of the Cold War, she thought that there was a strong possibility that we would feel the impact of the war where we were, and that we could even die in it. So for the first time, she questioned me and my two younger brothers directly about our relationship to Jesus Christ. I remember her asking each of us, if you were to die, do you know where you would be? So my whole understanding of the word crisis rises from the vivid memories I have of that atmosphere in those difficult days. I learned subsequently that it was a period of 13 days before the crisis resolved. For Hezekiah and the people of Judah, the crisis arose without much notice. The Assyrian army had previously invaded the kingdom and made short work of reducing the kingdom's walled cities. And then the Assyrians, led by their king Sennacherib, turned their attention to Jerusalem even after the payment of tribute and resolved to force its surrender as well. And it was then that Hezekiah had to face the critical decisions that would determine the survival or destruction of his kingdom. He was more than halfway through his reign, as it turned out. Of course, he did not realize that such was the case. He was around the age of 40. He was, we would say, in the prime of his life. Although to be 40 years of age in the ancient world was already to be on the downward side of life. He faced four powerful realities as we see them unfolding in the biblical accounts in these passages, to which we will have occasion to refer. First, the first reality he faced was policy failure. The first realization that King Hezekiah had was that his effort to buy the Assyrians off was a miserable disaster. We saw earlier in chapter 18, beginning in verse 13, the story of the previous invasion, and in verse 14, Hezekiah saying to the king of Assyria, I have offended, return from me, that which thou puttest on me will I bear. And the king of Assyria appointed unto Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. And we saw in verse 18 how Hezekiah had to cut the gold from the doors of the temple and from the pillars that Hezekiah had overlaid to give that gold to the king of Assyria. But the policy gained for them at most a few months. It was a very expensive tribute. Because the king of Assyria came back. He laid siege to the city of Lachish, which was not too far from Jerusalem, and then detached a large force, probably close to 200,000 men, to send to Jerusalem and to compel the defenders of Jerusalem to surrender. In particular, The king of Assyria directed Rabshakeh to deliver the message to Hezekiah that there was no way out and that he must surrender to spare the lives of the city's inhabitants. It was the crisis. This was the major test of Hezekiah's reign. And the painful realization for Hezekiah was that his effort to avoid the fight, his effort to have peace in his time, did nothing but to impoverish his kingdom and to rob the temple in Jerusalem of its splendor. The aggravation of the policy failure was to become evident in the Assyrian message, which is the second thing that we find here. He had to confront policy failure, but he also had to confront propaganda force. The Assyrians came to Jerusalem and launched a campaign, a vicious campaign, to undermine any effort that Hezekiah would make to inspire his subjects to hold their ground. So we read some of that effort in verse 19. Thus saith the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this wherein thou trustest? So they cited the weakness of potential allies like the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh. If you depend on the Pharaoh, you're not going to have any success. The Pharaoh, the king of Assyria said, is like a bruised reed. If you lean upon the king of Pharaoh, it will go into your hand and pierce your hand. Then the argument was, if you say we trust in the Lord, then they said, well, that's the God whose high places Hezekiah has taken away. In the great religious revival that accompanied Hezekiah's accession to the throne, they had taken away the high places of the false gods. And they said, those are the high places that belong to the true God. So they said, you can't trust in the Lord your God either. And the viciousness of the propaganda machine appeared in the face of efforts that Hezekiah's counselors made to keep the defenders from being discouraged, from hearing the message of the Assyrians. So we find, for example, in verses 27 through 32, that Rabshakeh, having been encouraged to speak to them in the Syrian language, spoke instead in the Hebrew language and delivered the message. Notice in verse 28, he cried with a loud voice in the Jews' language and spake, saying, hear the word of the great king, the king of Assyria. Let not Hezekiah deceive you. That is, don't believe what your king says. He's not going to be able to prevail. Notice how many times in these speeches you hear the description of the king of Assyria as the great king of Assyria. In other words, Hezekiah, by implication, he is very much a minor entity. He is strictly minor league in his comparison to the great king of Assyria. So they mounted this effort to dissuade the people from trusting in anything that the king said. And we notice in verses 31 and 32 that this campaign also had a positive dimension to it, where the great king of Assyria said, just make an agreement, just surrender, just come out to me, and then you can stay where you live now until we have everything organized to take you away to another place that will be just like the place where you live now. that you may live and not die. Don't listen to Hezekiah when he tries to persuade you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. So this propaganda machine fired up, and we ought to remember that in every conflict of this nature, there is propaganda. There is falsehood being delivered. And some have made a very detailed study of the power of propaganda, the power of the lie, and they use the power of the lie in an effort to gain the advantage. But notice that the people here in verse 36 had been given a command by Hezekiah, and that command was not to answer. The people held their peace and answered him not a word, for the king's commandment was saying, answer him not. So they made all these speeches, and there was no reply from any of the people. But the heart of this effort that the Assyrians were making betrayed their complete ignorance of what the Jews believed about God. And that brings me to the third aspect, the third reality that Hezekiah confronted here, perversion's folly. Notice how the Assyrians spoke authoritatively about God. They said, oh, we know that Hezekiah is encouraging you to trust in the Lord, but the one that he's encouraging you to trust in is the one upon whom he has waged war, in effect. He's taken away all his altars, all his high places. He's ordered that you sacrifice only before the altar in Jerusalem. Now, all of that was true. Of course, Hezekiah had done that. But they said this amounted to Hezekiah's attack upon the Lord. But not content with that, notice that they also stressed the argument, what they thought was the truth, concerning the belief of the Jews in the Lord's sovereign control. Because we read in verse 25, am I now come up without the Lord against this place to destroy it? The Lord said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. That was, of course, an absolute lie. But it was a lie from the propaganda machine. Yes, the Lord had sent the Assyrians to destroy the northern kingdom. But he had given no such directive to the Assyrians regarding the southern kingdom. So they had what they thought was powerful argument to make regarding God, but they did not know anything about God. Notice what they said at the end of chapter 18 in verses 33 through 35. Hath any of the gods of the nations delivered at all his land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? They were saying, look around. Look at the other countries around. Have any of those gods delivered their people? Where are the gods of Hamath and of Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim, Hena, and Iva? Have they delivered Samaria out of mine hand? In other words, the northern kingdom worshiped false gods. How did those gods deliver the northern kingdom out of the hand of the king of Assyria? The question in verse 35, who are they among all the gods of the countries that have delivered their country out of mine hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem out of mine hand? Now let's look also at 2 Chronicles chapter 32. 2 Chronicles chapter 32. And look at verse 17. He wrote also letters to rail. So it wasn't just that they spoke, but they wrote letters. He wrote also letters to rail on the Lord God of Israel and to speak against him, saying, as the gods of the nations of other lands have not delivered their people out of mine hand, so shall not the God of Hezekiah deliver his people out of mine hand. Then they cried with a loud voice in the Jews' speech unto the people of Jerusalem that were on the wall to affright them and to trouble them that they might take the city. And they spake against the God of Jerusalem as against the gods of the people of the earth, which were the work of the hands of man. They said, your God is just like all the others. They had a perverted view of the one who was the God of the people who lived in Judah. They said, your God is like all the others. None of the others have been of any help. Your God will not be of any help. So they were pursuing then every possible means of intimidation. And again, I say it's easy for us to sit here tonight and to hear the account of this event, this crisis. But for those people, they had to listen to it. They had to hear those words. Now, hopefully, they knew the truth, but Hezekiah certainly knew the truth. And this effort to speak authoritatively about the God of the people of Judah was what came to be the fatal folly of the Assyrian king and the army. Because they thought that the God of the Hebrews was like all the false deities they had already encountered. But they were going to find out it was not the case. Because Hezekiah and his people had a place to which to appeal. And that's the fourth thing that we find. Hezekiah came to confront the reality of prayer's fruitfulness. Now, when we continue this series, in our next message, we're going to look in some depth at the prayer of Hezekiah and the prayer of Isaiah on this occasion. But we already noticed, in particular, the words of 2 Chronicles 32 and verse 20. And for this cause, Hezekiah the king and the prophet Isaiah the son of Amoz prayed and cried to heaven. And then if you look back at 2 Kings 19, the following chapter, we find that Hezekiah rent his clothes and covered himself with sackcloth and went into the house of the Lord. Why? To pray. And then they sent a message to Isaiah. We read in verse 5, the servants of King Hezekiah came to Isaiah. Hezekiah had ordered them to do so in verse 2. Send people to Isaiah, the prophet, the son of Amoz. So they sent to Isaiah. And Isaiah gave them the message which we shall have cause to consider in due course. But if you will turn to the prophecy of Isaiah and chapter 36, you'll find the same narrative basically as what we have in 2 Kings 18 and 2 Chronicles 32. But in Isaiah 37 and verse 1, you find essentially what you encounter in 2 Kings 19. It came to pass when King Hezekiah heard it that he rent his clothes and covered himself with sackcloth and went in to the house of the Lord. You find there the same message sent to Isaiah, the parallel passage. They went to the Lord. We read in 2 Chronicles 32, they went to the Lord to pray. The king and the prophet both prayed. And the prophet had a message to send back to the king, to which we will come in due course. But let us notice the approach that they took. Hezekiah especially, he was humble and reverent. He laid aside his royal attire and put on sackcloth to go into the house of the Lord. Why? He recognized how weak he was. He recognized how much the people needed the Lord's intervention and the Lord's power. They would find much help in the place of prayer. Indeed, this was one of the crowning glories of Hezekiah's reign on this occasion, when they sought the Lord in this time of crisis and found the answer. We'll have occasion to see what that answer was, how miraculous it was, how mighty the victory was over the Assyrians. But Jerusalem did not fall to the Assyrians. And the great king of Assyria, when he returned to his own land, was assassinated by his own sons while he was engaged in prayer to his own false god. So God had a commentary upon the threats that Sennacherib lodged. And Hezekiah led his people to seek the Lord. And that is the answer in the crisis. It is to seek the Lord. It is to cry unto the Lord. Not simply as a rubber stamp to whatever plan you hatch, but to seek the Lord that he may give direction and that he may learn what it means, that he may teach you what it means truly to rely upon the one who has all power. So in the crisis, Hezekiah's response was to turn to the Lord. We'll have occasion to see the significance of that prayer when we come back to consider the life of Hezekiah. May God bless the word to every heart tonight.